Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted and privileged to welcome a very, very senior professional from the world of health, a former colleague from the board of Gavi, and of course, someone who's well-recognized in the world of public health, etc., Mr. Kevin Clark from Washington, D.C., USA. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Ashutosh.
Thank you. Kevin is the Senior Vice President, Chief Operating Officer, and General Counsel for the Foundation for the National Institutes of Health. He has been the Head of Governance and the Assistant Secretary for Gavi, which is where, as I mentioned, he and I work together. So, Kevin, let's talk a little bit about the foundations for the National Institutes of Health. Give me a little overview of what does FNIH do and what is its primary mission?
Sure. So FNIH was the brainchild of the U.S. Congress.
Wow.
And it put it together to support the mission of the National Institutes of Health in the United States. NIH is the world's greatest biomedical research agency. Mm. It is the engine scientifically and financially of innovations for treatments and cures for patients. Congress created us to accelerate that work. And we do it by creating and leading alliances and public-private partnerships that advance breakthroughs for our patients. It's a really exciting mission, and I just love talking about it.
And how does FNIH support NIH?
So we do it in a many different ways, but let me give you three. So one of the ways we do it is we can raise funds from the private sector. That's something NIH can't do. We can do that. A second way is we're a project incubator. So we can get together NIH, other U.S. government agencies such as FDA or the Department of Defense in some cases. Sometimes there are non-U.S. government regulators and institutions that are involved, such as the European Medicines Agency. You can also get together life sciences companies, academia, you name it, to try to figure out new models of working together. The biggest way we do this is through our biomedical public-private partnerships. And that's where we get together the top people in the health sector. And we say, how do we build a platform to tackle issues ranging from Alzheimer's disease to Parkinson's disease to heart disease to autoimmune disease to infectious disease? It's really exciting. It's something we've been doing for more than a quarter century, and it's become really, really critical for NIH to fulfill its mission.
And one of the things that I have often seen with institutions like FNIH is that you work a lot with other partners. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the key partnerships and collaborations that FNIH has, and how do you work with a lot of them?
Yeah, let me give you an example that we're really proud of that's very recent. So we did a study with a concise, important, single question. What a single dose of a common, inexpensive antibiotic, in this case, azithromycin, something we're all familiar with, reduce the risk of death from sepsis in birthing moms and their babies in resource-constrained countries? Really, really important public health question, really important question for equity, you know, and something everybody can rally around. So NIH, the Gates Foundation, half a dozen universities, including a medical center in Belagavi, India, got together to do this study. And we discovered two things. First, for moms, death from sepsis decreased 35%. That's an amazing outcome for moms. In fact, it's so amazing, we stopped the trial early because we didn't think it was appropriate to continue to have a control group anymore. Everyone deserves sepsis. It's an amazing outcome.
Amazing.
The second thing we found out is babies really aren't affected. It doesn't, it doesn't really help them. That's
Correct.
Still an important discovery because now we know. It's not an open question. So this is the kind of partnership, a global partnership, that we helped incubate, execute, and now that information is all over the world and will save lives from now and in perpetuity.
Correct, correct. And continuing with these partnerships, how do these public-private partnerships support scientific research and innovation?
Yeah, so let me start with what a public-private partnership is. And this is one person's definition. There are many
Correct.
Out there. Here's
Correct.
One definition I use. It's when the government and the private sector, neither of which are monolithic. There are many aspects of government, many private sector actors. But the fact is, you're pulling from these two sectors, and they bring to bear their comparative advantages. And they share critical decision-making components over what a project or an enterprise is going to be and critical elements of it. They share implementation and execution of that project. They share credit for the consequences, the outcomes of that project or how it's conducted. And it's all done in an atmosphere of trust. So when I'm talking about public-private partnerships, that's the definition I'm using. So why is that important? If you believe that neither government nor any particular private sector actor has all the answers, has all the funding, can do it alone, then partnering provides the way. It de-silos the work. It is the essence of how the whole can be greater than the sum of its parts. You make a credible argument that government and private sector should stay in their corners. And those that are critics of public-private partnerships will argue that. And that is a coherent argument. However, that doesn't come without costs. It's not necessarily a safe position because you, by doing that, you are silent. You are making the assumption that one partner somewhere has all the answers, has all the funding, will do it, and in fact will take the steps and initiative to do it without anyone else's prodding. That's why partnerships are so powerful if they are built right and managed well.
Great response. Thank you. My next question is that what are some of the unique challenges and opportunities that FNIH faces in supporting the advancement of health research?
Yeah. So partnerships, let me go back into this idea of partnerships.
Yeah.
They don't run themselves. They have to be well managed.
Absolutely.
If they were easy, if people would just do them, it would be our behavior.
Correct.
But you have to build them, and you have to build them intentionally. FNIH was really created as a hub organization, a place through which the partnerships kind of flow through in a way that the center of gravity. It doesn't necessarily make it the most important part, but it makes it an essential part to be able to do this. You mentioned Gavi. Gavi's the same way. It is the hub through which immunization in resource-constrained countries gets done. So if partners naturally work together, you wouldn't need it. But because it requires consistent greasing of the wheels to make the partnership go, it's required to make it fair. It's required to make it ethical. And it's required, frankly, to keep the quality. So that is the key mechanical issue when it comes to the challenge that we're confronted with in putting these together.
Very, very interesting. My next question is that how does FNIH balance the needs of public health with the interests of the various stakeholders, which includes government, public sector, private sector, and the research community?
Yeah, so this is what we mean by managed, right? This doesn't just happen on its own. So clearly, there's a value proposition to every partner that joins. Okay, I don't think that's a secret. The idea that you put a partnership and everyone's doing it out of charity doesn't mean that there isn't some, you know, altruistic purpose. There's a value proposition for everyone, for sure. What we have to be on the lookout is a few things. One, that no one gets a preferential economic benefit. That's where partnerships can go sideways,
Correct.
and public trust in what you're doing can erode, as particularly when you have government and private sector involved, and government has to first and foremost protect the public trust. So nobody should be getting, in most cases, a preferential economic. Secondly, you have to make sure there aren't partners that are particularly nefarious players in the field. Everyone can have a value, but again, if the public looks at it and says, well, that partner's in it only for that, and that undermines public trust, that can be a, that's, for example, tobacco partners. It's why we don't work with tobacco.
Correct.
It's why Gavi doesn't work with tobacco. It's why WHO doesn't work from tobacco. There are some that say, not necessarily to us, but you've seen these projects out there where they say, hey, you can, if they're offering money and you can put it to a purpose that happens to undermine them, why wouldn't you? Well, if you do that, the public says, I just don't trust what you're giving us.
Correct.
It's not going to do any good. So you have to look out for nefarious purpose. The
Correct.
Third thing, and this is really managed, is you have to be careful when there's a single donor. It doesn't mean you can't do it. You do have to take extra caution to understand why they're in it, why you've elected to not diversify your donor base, and move from there. The second thing I would say about balancing stakeholders, and I'll take a cue here from an Oxford professor by the name of Bent Lupier. He encourages project managers to think slow, act fast.
Wow.
The idea being that preparation really ensures that once you hit go on something, you are hurling towards the finish line. You don't want to leave things open forever. Before we implement, we have a design phase. So we're not just hitting go on projects. These things are carefully designed. And those partners, you asked about balancing stakeholders. Those stakeholders are involved in the design. So if we don't get a design that everyone's comfortable with, we don't have a project. If we do get a design everyone's comfortable with, we're now all on the same page. We all understand the calculus of the balance, and it's transparent. And transparency helps solve, as you know, a lot of these challenges.
Absolutely. Well said. Great response.
Thank you.
Let me now move, Kevin, to a more topical question of the COVID-19. And I want to get your perspective on how has or how did the COVID-19 pandemic impact FNIH's operations and priorities? And what are some of the lessons that have been learned to manage a global health crisis?
Pandemics change everything.
Correct.
There are a few things that create systemic change, war being the other one that just seems very obvious, or some kind of economic panic. But all of us, there are pandemics of smaller scale that go on, but a true global pandemic is something that just affects every aspect of life. We know it intuitively.
Correct.
There's not a whole much more that I can say that your viewers open there saying, I know this, I know this. So how did it affect us? Being connected to NIH meant there would obviously be some kind of role that we needed to play in this. And so let me tell you a quick story. If I take you back to March of 2020,
right,
and people who are really paying attention had known for a couple months this might be coming, but I think this gained really popular traction in mid-March. About a week after that, the head of the NIH called the head of our research partnerships division and said, we need to have a leadership role because we need, NIH being in the middle of this, it is the hub. While we may be the hub of partnership, they are the hub of the whole biomedical. So how do we get our arms around this? So two things happened very quickly. One, using our convening power, we organized a Zoom meeting, which included the scientific directors of the biggest companies in the world who might be able to play a role in this. It included the leadership of NIH, Included leadership of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the names that you know and you've seen on television. They included the head of FDA, included the British regulator, European Medicine Agency, you name it. Everyone was on this phone call to say, how can we make a difference on this? You can only do that if you have some credibility.
Correct.
So you can't create a foundation like this out of thin air. You have to have credibility. And so what was decided is to create a partnership on a model that this group had pioneered, you know, over those 25 years. And that became a project known as the Accelerated COVID-19 Therapeutic Interventions and Vaccines Program, or ACT. And it was announced by the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services 2 weeks ago. And it has many aims.
Yeah.
But let me tell you about one of them. If, you know, you're testing a therapy, right? You need to do a clinical trial. Those are time intensive. They are costly. And you have to have a place to do it, right? You need to have labs and health workers and patients who are willing to put their own bodies on the line to do this work. That's not an easy thing to do. And yet, as you recall at the beginning, there were hundreds of people saying, I've got the compound that's going to solve COVID-19. And so you had, you know, hundreds of these chasing very little clinical trial capacity to test them. And so what did you get? You had these instances of people doing a trial on 20 people. You know, you could test water on 20 people and come up with any outcome you wanted. And so you had really not great decision making on this, and you're not really accelerating. So what did Doctiv do? NIH created a portal, said, if you think you have a compound that would be useful, send it here. We set up a public-private partnership of the best minds in government, academia, life science companies to evaluate these compounds under predetermined criteria. Now, if you were a life science company and you were submitting a compound, you were out of the room. You get to reach your own compound.
Correct.
They looked at hundreds of compounds and said, what are the best ones? Whatever they thought were the best ones, they transmitted to NIH. And then NIH, in its own power, decided what would go into NIH's fully powered clinical trials.
Wow.
And it wasn't just for one kind of therapy. You remember people would get cytokine storms, like an overactive immune response, which could be deadly in some cases. Yep. So we tested immune modulators. We had a whole clinical trial platform just for immune modulators. You recall people were getting strokes from COVID-19. So we had a whole platform for anticoagulants.
Yeah.
You recall monoclonal antibodies. Which is to try to reduce symptoms, severity of symptoms, length of symptoms. We had two trials for that, one in an outpatient setting, one in an inpatient setting.
Okay.
So the idea is you want to have a lot of shots on target, but they have to be fully powered. And so you have to find a way to get the best stuff in there. And so you get the best minds together. All the people who are the best minds, no matter where they happen to be employed, helped evaluate these things and get the right things into the right trials at the right time. That's the kind of partnership that we
need. It's amazing. You know, it is so reassuring when you were telling me this entire narrative about COVID-19, you know, and how between FNIH and NIH, you were able to pull together, you know, the best brains in the world. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of my viewers and listeners would be happy to learn that the health of the world is in very, very safe hands. But moving on now, Kevin, how does FNIH ensure that the research you support is both ethical and legally compliant? And what role does the general counsel play in this process?
Yeah, it's an important, critical question.
Correct.
And when you're general counsel, you spend a lot of time thinking
absolutely.
About it.
Absolutely.
So there's no safe position. I said, you could say, we're not going to do partnerships. Everyone run to their own corners, and then you get nothing done.
Correct.
And then nothing done, right? So first, what I would say, ethics has to be baked into the culture of your programs. You know, and that's, again, not something you can do overnight. It's something that's earned over decades. You remember that last aspect of public-private partnerships in an atmosphere of trust. And it isn't just the trust among the partners, it's also trust with the public. And the public isn't monolithic. The public has questions. And some members of the public, no matter what you do, will still impute something to it. And so you have to live with a certain amount of that, which doesn't make sleeping very easy. But you know, the struggle is the point. Think about these things and make the best decisions you can. I mean, leadership lives on the wobbly branch, right? You have to go out on the thing if you're going to get something. So the number one thing is to make sure ethics and the intentionality of ethics is built into the culture of your program. So that means for us, there are agreed upon milestones that everybody knows. There's agreed upon ways that we share data among the partnerships. If a partner is deviating, to have a way to get them back into what they're supposed to be doing. This is where shared accountability, another line from the definition, is so critical. If you've built a culture of shared accountability, it ends up solving a lot of problems through self-correction. So on the legal aspect, first to say, for all these partners, their legal counsel there is a special role when you're the legal counsel of the hub organization. It's just different. You are de facto counsel to the partnership and not just your institution. So what does that mean? Lawyers, as you know, are trained to be zealous advocates of their client, get the best deal possible, right? So sometimes one partner, and maybe it's their partner's lawyer, operates in that mode because they spend most of the day negotiating bilateral commercial deals.
Correct.
That doesn't work for partnerships, but it's not what they're used to. So sometimes we have to leverage the partnership. And so when we're all together, it sometimes requires handing them the mic and saying, we all came here to partner today. Can you please inform us why that is difficult for you or no longer possible?
Right.
Sometimes when they're just taking a tactic that brings them back in line, but sometimes there's a real issue there. And now it's out in the open. We can talk about it. And another partner might say, oh, that's a challenge for me too. And at least now you're doing it together in an atmosphere of trust and not the typical adversarial time that lawyers are generally trained to operate in. We have to get other partners' lawyers out of that mode and into a mode of our business partners, our clients. They're working together to do something. We have to do that too.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you. I have time for two more questions. My next question to you, Kev, is that how do organizations like FNIH work to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion in scientific research? Because literally, the world is your oyster when it comes to scientific research. And given the fact that you are a premier institution, you probably can get the best minds from all over the world.
Yeah, this is so critical for us. This is not, we don't put something on a website when something happens and say, look at us, and then it's not part of who we are. It's essential to who we are. Our values have five elements. Collaboration, not a surprise, right? Integrity, hopefully not a surprise.
Yep, absolutely.
Ingenuity. Gratitude.
Okay.
Which is really important for organizations like us. And equity. Equity is baked into what we do. It's led by Janelle Lewis, an incredible rising star in this area, who, you know, she would say we've done it collaboratively. I would say leadership requires someone to rally around, and we rally around her. We're so grateful to her. But to your question of, so what does it require? From my perspective, it requires effort and intentionality to do something. It doesn't just happen. Maybe sometime in the future, it will just happen. But that's not where we are. So what could I do? Like, we're all searching, like, what could I do? And there are a few things that I tried to do to help. One is I needed to show my colleagues that it mattered to me, and to do it very visibly and do it authentically. The way I did it is I had the privilege and continue to have this privilege to co-chair an effort with Georgetown University, UNAIDS, and the Fogarty International Center at NIH to advise the WHO policymakers and the Bureau on discrete issues for the emerging pandemic treatment. This is not meant as a, you know, should they do it or should they not do it, but in a way, how do we provide sort of the world's views on the different possibilities to allow policy. We've done three of these projects, but the third one was on advancing equity.
Okay.
Equity is the core principle of the treaty that's coming. How do you operationalize it? There's too many. I mean, you've seen this, Ashutosh. There's so much literature out there saying if we would just shake the official development assistant tree a little harder, then, you know, we'll have the money and the know-how to treat pandemics. But, you know, we wanted to do something different. We didn't want the same people and the same talking about the same stuff. So we got together people from around the world in disciplines as diverse as biomedical science to ethics to law to capital to try to ideate things that will work. Give all of that to WHO and they can decide how that work gets taken forward. And I'll tell you, our colleagues from resource-constrained countries said to us afterwards, said, your meeting was different. Let me tell you why it was different. We go to a lot of meetings. We get on a plane in economy class. We fly indirectly to somewhere in the north. We sit in the meeting, and the same people in the north talk to the other people in the north, and maybe we can say something at some point. We go to a lot of these meetings. Your meeting, our meeting, you flew us, not in economy class, much more directly to the meeting site. And the way your meeting was set up, everyone sat at the top of the dais to chair a discussion. It wasn't the same people talking to each other. But in fact, everyone had a leadership. You know, and you, in logistically, you treated us the same way you treated your own staff. I mean, that matters. It matters because it tells people you're serious in purpose, and we were. So it mattered for the project, but it also mattered that our staff saw that and that we meant that. So when I say it takes effort, that didn't just happen. It meant looking at our roster and saying, are we doing this? And it meant having a piece of work product at the end that could allow operationalizing equity and not just another report talking about the same stuff that would change anything. That's to me how you can operationalize equity. I have other stories too, very passionate about it, but that's one that I hope your listeners. Amazing.
No, it's fantastic, you know, and equity is so important. And thank you for articulating it so well. But Kevin, we've now run out of time. I wish I could just carry on talking to you. But thank you so much for talking to me about your own incredible journey with FNIH. Thank you for introducing me and all our listeners to what FNIH does. And you seem to be doing some amazing work. And hopefully I'll reach out to you again for some more detailed discussions at some time later this year. Thank you for talking to me about how FNIH responded to the COVID pandemic. I mean, I didn't realize that between NIH, FIH, FNIH, you could actually pull together the world's resources. But as I was thinking, it's the question is why not? I mean, you are one of the most powerful institutes in the world. Thank you also for talking to me about so many different aspects of diversity, equity, inclusion, and for giving such great examples. Thank you for speaking to me and good luck.
Thank you, Ashutosh. I feel such gratitude to you. Thank you for being such a good friend, and thank you to your listeners.
Thank you.
What a service you do for them.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.